times a day. Late.
Do you know the way to San Jose? 20 bucks a day on the dock of the bay. Niggas, I'm
zoom a little zoom in a rocket ship. Off we go on a trip. Heading for the moon at a rocket clip. We're gonna zoom, zoom, rocket. Zoom a little zoom, now we're almost free from the Earth's gravity. Zooming to the moon at terrific speed, because there is no friction. Soon we'll see if the moon is made out of green cheese. Ha, 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 ha. Zoom, we're here at the moon. Let's see what the moon is like.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to My Science Project on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. Today's show, well, it might have a little bit of a morbid twist, to be honest with you, but we'll try and keep it light wherever possible. What we're going to do today is feature a whole lot about CPR and the heart. And so I guess sort of the emphasis here is on staying alive. And if you were listening closely, you probably heard the opening riff to a huge dance favorite, Staying Alive, and we'll get to that in a second, don't you worry. So we're going to be talking a lot about CPR and the success rates of CPR and the science behind it, and we'll also include an interview with a team of students from UBC who have developed a way to improve the way in which CPR is taught. And they've done this through something called the iDoll, so you'll hear about that later on in the show. I'm also going to cover the Lasker Awards, which were just announced this week. They are a set of awards that honor biomedical and clinical contributions to research in America. And this year, recently, they honored two doctors in particular who helped develop tools and techniques for heart valve replacement. So we'll get to that. And, you know, keeping with this theme of staying alive and perhaps a little morbid twist, we'll ask the question, do rock stars really live fast and die young? I found a recent report that attempts to answer this question, so we'll get into that with a whole lot of statistics and epidemiology a little later on. There are lots of local events to talk about, lots of music to play, and a little bit of back-to-school recruiting to do on behalf of my science project and on behalf of Let's Talk Science. Now, before we get into some random news and stories about hearts and staying alive, I'd like to mention that coming up here at CITR is the funding drive. That'll be the first 2 weeks of October. And so on October 4th, Julia and I will reunite here on air to promote our show and to promote CITR and all the great shows here. And so that's the 2007 funding drive on October 4th. So we'd love all your support by listening and pledging at that time. Now, before we get into the meat of things today, as I promised, here is Staying Alive.
We'll be right back. definition for the word shindig. Shindig, noun, informal. Definition 1, an elaborate or large dance, party, or other celebration. Definition 2, CITR's annual battle of the bands.
It's that time of year again. Shindig, CITR's annual battle of the bands. Come on down every Tuesday to hear Vancouver's best unsigned bands duke it out every week. Past contestants have included The Saltines, Clover Honey, Dandy Wind, They Shoot Horses, Don't They, Victoria Victoria, and 3 Inches of Blood. Shindig promises killer prizes for the winners, entertainment for the viewers, and, as always, the dreaded jokes for beer.
Dogs are different than cats, and hey, what if Jack Nicholson were a Flamity Blue?
Hey, what if, We Are the World was sung by the cast of Friends? I think it might go something like this. All right,
Shindig kicks off on September 11th and continues for the following 8 Tuesdays at the Railway Club, located at 579 Dunsmuir Street. Doors open at 8 p.m. and show starts at 9:30. Shindig is brought to you by CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
Hi there, you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Anne, and this is my science project. And if anything's for sure, it is back to school time. It is autumn as of tomorrow, officially. And, it's back to shindig time. There's all kinds of great things that happen in autumn. And there's also all kinds of crappy things that happen in autumn. In fact, today is a particularly gray day that's confirming all our deepest, darkest suspicions that winter's coming to get us. And scientists pay a lot of attention to how winter affects animals and how winters affect people as well. And there's a scientist in particular by the name of Cheng Chi Li from the University of Texas, Houston Medical School. And he has got his eye on hibernating animals. As you all know, hibernating animals sleep through the winter, survive through the winter in sort of a slowed-down state or a state of torpor. Their body temperature drops, their heart and breathing rates drop massively, and their metabolism changes primarily from a glucose-burning metabolism to a fat-burning metabolism. And it's right there that the light bulb went on. If certain animals can live on their fat reserves, burning them for many months at a time, might we be able to induce this state in obese, overweight humans to promote fat loss, weight loss? Might this be an effective treatment for obesity? And this is an idea that comes from Cheng Chi Li's discovery that the chemical 5-adenosine monophosphate, or 5-AMP, can induce a similar state in mice. Now, mice don't normally hibernate, but by application of this chemical, you can force the mice into this state of torpor. So what Li is actually proposing, believe it or not, and is quite an extraordinary idea if you really spend some time thinking about it, is an injection or a pill of this particular chemical that could induce a similar state in humans, leading to accompanying metabolic changes that might increase the treatment of obesity. So I don't know how that one sits with you. Perhaps it's time for humans to crawl into a dark room and sleep off the fat, but we'll see how that actually goes. What I'm going to try and play for you here is a whole new splash in the world of science. And with any luck, the video is going to be running and you'll be able to hear the track that goes along with it.
Hi, my name is Eric Sheff and I work at the Salk Institute for Biological Studies. And I'm going to talk to you today about a paper called Structural Evolution of the Protein Kinase Like Superfamily. And this is work I did with Phil Born, and the citation is available on this slide if you'd like to look at the paper. So first, I'd like to introduce the concept of protein superfamilies. Traditionally, when we talk about protein relationships, people speak of protein families, which are groups of related proteins that share a clear sequence relationship, and usually they have a similar function. When we get to the protein
superfamily, so what you're hearing in the background right now is, admittedly a rather dry discussion of a particular group's scientific publication, but this is a whole new thing on the science promotion and science communication tract. This is a clip from a new website called SciVeeTV, or S-C-I-V-E-E-TV. And what it is a website put out by the National Science Foundation and the online open access publishers PLOS, or the Public Library of Science. And they've launched this site just this summer. It's called SciVee. essentially it's the YouTube for scientists, a video hosting platform that can allow scientists the opportunity to discuss further what they've published, or in other instances, to have a little bit of fun with an online video. It's not all completely academic discussions. There are quite a few video demonstrations of fun scientific concepts. So far, SciVee is a venue for rather esoteric and technical videos, like you just heard. But it can't be long before a little more drama, a little more Hollywood, or a little more flair takes SciVee, takes a SciVee video clip into viral mode, spreading to everybody's work work online desktop. You know, I would wager that many of you have seen the video, taken a moment possibly out of your workday to see the video where a Diet Coke and a pack of Mentos take flight. And I'm sure there's similarly exciting stories about science soon coming to SciVee.tv. Scientific experiments often have heavy technical and manual components to their execution, so I could also see this website being a great place to offer a little bit of training, particularly for those scientists in the labs of busy postdocs or where supervisor skills are a little bit rusty. So check it out. Maybe you'd like to contribute something yourself. Even I'm sure there's a place for comments as well as demonstrations and discussions of science, and that's www.scivee.tv. Now, what I want to ease into here is our piece on the rock star demise. So I'm going to introduce this with a long-gone rock star herself, Janis Joplin. That's Janis Joplin singing Take a Piece of My Heart. And, you know, she's in a fair amount of company as a rock star who died really before her talent was fully expanded and before her years were really lived out. And I believe it was Keith Richards who's famous for saying, and this is a quote, "I was number one on the Who's Most Likely to Die list for 10 years, and I was really disappointed when I fell off the list." So truly, there is a theme and a common analysis of what's going on with rock stars, and that's that they live fast and die young. But do they really? There's a lot of epidemiological approaches that could be applied to this question, and Mark Bellies and colleagues tried to answer this question in April 2007, publishing their findings in the Journal of Epidemiology and Community Health. Their article is entitled "Elvis to Eminem: Quantifying the Price of Fame Through Early Mortality of European and North American Rock and Pop Stars." Now, no doubt there are ample studies examining the quality of life of musicians, and these confirm that pop stars suffer high levels of stress and depression and substance abuse. But assessments of mortality are normally based on comparisons of the age at death of the rock star versus the general population. And if you look at the age of death, 27 happens to be a pretty hot year, so perhaps you remember your 27th year, or perhaps you're 27 right now, or coming up to that. And I think that can be officially called the year of the rock star burnout. Dying at 27 were Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, Hank Williams, and Kurt Cobain. Anyway, our author, Mark Bellies, argues that this approach is unreliable because there's widespread attention granted to rock star deaths, particularly young rock star deaths, because they're passing away before the peak of their career, and there are already a group of people who are in the public eye. So that means that deaths out of the public eye go unnoticed, sort of skewing these results. Additionally, there are so many young stars, so that the ratio of young deaths to older deaths among rock stars might not accurately reflect what's really going on. The greater proportion of youth stars also means a decrease in the likelihood of deaths from cancer and heart disease, which are diseases normally associated with more elderly people, and an increase in likelihood of deaths by causes more common among youth, which are deaths due to alcohol, drugs, accidents, suicides, and violence. So in the study that I want to tell you about, the mortality of 1,064 famous musicians taken from the list of the 1,000 top albums of all time in both North America and Europe, the mortality of this group was compared to continent-matched, age-matched, sex-matched, and race-matched general population averages, and that was sort of the control. So the question is the mortality of North American and European stars different than the average mortality of the general population? So the way they began to do this was they picked a date, and that date was December 31st, 2005, and they examined all people in the study for their status. Essentially, are they alive or dead? Another important measurement that was incorporated into the study was the question of onset of fame. When did these famous musicians acquire their fame? In other words, at what age did they first achieve chart success, or at what age did they first release their album? And so in this particular group, the earliest case was Elvis Presley achieving fame by those criteria in 1956, and the latest was Eminem achieving fame in 1999. Now, on to the results. Out of the 1,064 pop stars examined, 100 of them had died. In North America, the median age of death of the rock star was 41.78 years, and yet it was only 35.18 years in Europe. Now, I mentioned that one of the points examined was the time at which they'd achieved their fame, and relating to that, it was quite interesting to learn that if you achieve fame before 1980, your chances of survival, your mortality rate, is going to be a lot better. Maybe there's something around 1980 that marks the beginning of an era where rock stars party hard, perform high, and trash hotel rooms or something. Anyway, as for the cause of death, unsurprisingly, 25% of those rock stars that died, died due to drugs, alcohol, or overdose. So the average rock star has to survive 25 years of fame before their mortality begins to recover to levels similar to that among the average population. But within those first 25 years of fame, the mortality is 2 to 3 times higher, so you're 2 to 3 times more likely to die as a pop star than you are as an average human being. After 25 years, the mortality starts to normalize for the European group, but not for the North American group. So for some reason, North Americans are suffering... North American rock stars, that is, continue to suffer higher rates of mortality even after 25 years of fame. And this article kind of ends with a plea for public health and policy action, so kind of taking the high road here. Somewhat surprisingly, it calls for pity on the suffering for this group of rich and famous rockers, and it raises a warning bell about the message that is sent when rock and pop stars are used as spokespeople to positively influence public behavior. So that's an attempt, anyway, to answer the question, do rock stars really live fast and die young? Now, coming up next, I'm going to share with you an interview I conducted recently with UBC Team Idol and a look at cardiopulmonary resuscitation, or CPR, in 2008 and just how good it is. But before we get there, here is Emiliana Torini and Heartstopper.
Yeah. You said I began this messy state of love affairs, and I drink too much and smoke too fast, that this city's cleared my innocence. Coffee's pouring out my ears, it's the only thing they have in here, and my heart stops beating. And when it stops, my heart stops beating. And when it stops, my heart stopped beating. Number three still on my plate, I heard the trains are running late, and I laugh out loud, my life's a mess. I have gone too far in my lifelessness. Another coffee, it's on the house. The poor girl look is on the owner's spouse, and my heart stopped beating. And when it stops, my heart stopped beating. And when it stops, my heart stopped beating. Outside your house to make a scene, in my head you grab me passionately, but the lights are out, and in an hour I walked on home in the pouring shower, lost my keys in front of me. Smiles, he's handing me the blackest coffee you will ever see, and my heart stops beating. And when it stops, my heart stopped beating. And when it stops, my heart stopped beating.
Brittany.
Hit me, baby, one more time.
Xtina.
What a girl wants, what a girl needs, whatever makes me happy sets you free.
Mariah. CITR, where you'll hear none of those divas. CITR 101.9 FM, where the only divas you're likely to hear are Kathleen.
Suck my left one!
D'Amanda. Lydia.
Would somebody please inform the U.S. government that my uterus is not open to public debate.
CITR 101.9 FM, your true diva station.
Hi, welcome back to My Science Project, and thanks for joining us. This is the Staying Alive show. I've decided to call it that to avoid feeling a little bit too morbid about talking about rock star deaths and now talking about CPR. Here we go. Shortly coming up, we'll be hearing an interview with UBC's Team Idol. But to introduce you to that, I want to begin by looking a little bit at cardiopulmonary resuscitation, or CPR. As you'll most of you be very well aware, it's an emergency medical procedure for assisting victims of cardiac arrest or heart attack. It consists of a prescribed sequence of chest compressions and usually mouth-to-mouth breaths. And the aim of CPR is to maintain blood circulation artificially until the patient regains a heartbeat or is declared, unfortunately, dead. Now, if the Bible's anything to go by, the history of CPR is a long one. Apparently, in the Book of Kings, there's a description of Elisha warming a dead boy's body when he, quote, places his mouth over his. And, of course, old films from the early part of the 20th century depict what was formerly known as the Sylvester method, where the patient is laid on their back and their arms are raised above their head to to aid inhalation and then pressed against their chest to aid exhalation. The Nielsen technique is sort of a variation of the Sylvester method, and it can be seen in sort of nail-biter TV episodes from the 50s, such as Lassie. And in this particular approach to CPR, in the Nielsen technique, the patient is lying on their front, and much like the Sylvester technique, arms are raised and lowered in an attempt to encourage airflow in and out of the lungs. At any rate, by the mid-20th century, CPR was promoted as a skill that should be learned widely by the public, and it's a key part of early first aid and resuscitation. But the question here is, how successful is it, and how do you make it more successful? And how on earth can you possibly conduct an experiment to answer these questions? So if I can be a bit blunt or a bit flippant about it all, the ideal experiment to answer those questions an experiment designed to test various methods of CPR would ideally consist of a large group of clones or identically genetically identical people and a large group of clones who have just suffered a cardiac arrest. And what you would do is you would take one group and leave them untreated to see if they spontaneously recover, and then you take a few other different groups of clones where each group would receive various sequences of CPR. In this way, the success rate of different CPR strategies could be compared and could be compared against those who receive no CPR whatsoever. Of course, this is impossible for obvious ethical and practical reasons. We don't exactly have a large group of clones at our fingertips, and there are all kinds of ethical reasons why that would not be an appropriate experiment. And of course, it's only imaginary. But really, how good is CPR anyway? The short answer is CPR is not really all that good. It's actually unlikely to restart a stopped heart, at least when conducted away from the hospital by an untrained or lay bystander. What's really required is advanced medical treatment, and advanced medical treatment quickly. But what CPR does do is it maintains the circulation of oxygenated blood to keep vital organs alive. And this is essential particularly for the brain, because the brain can suffer damage if oxygenated blood flow stops. And if it stops for as little as 4 minutes, this damage can begin to set in. So CPR needs to be initiated as quickly as possible, and ideally within, at the most, 7 minutes. And when it does, it has a chance of delaying brain death and allowing the heart to remain responsive to defibrillation attempts later on by trained medics and paramedics at the scene. And studies have been done. Largely, they're case-based studies. And in a survey of case-based studies, the survival rate in cardiac arrest without CPR at all, so people who do not receive that kind of first aid treatment, is only 2%. However, it doubles. It does double to 4% if a bystander is able to initiate CPR early on. This contrasts strongly to cardiac arrest that occurs in hospital, witnessed by trained personnel who are able to offer complete care. And in those situations, 22% of people recover. And that's actually a study, a Canadian study, that was conducted between 1997 and 1999 in Alberta. In three teaching hospitals, and it was published in the Canadian Medical Association Journal by Peter G. Brimley and colleagues. But the standard protocols are constantly changing, and they're changing in order to improve the treatment that people are able to give to those in need. The last round of modifications to the standard resuscitation protocols took place in 2005, and this whole process is overseen by the International Resuscitation Councils, and they have a website. The broad aim of the International Resuscitation Council has been to simplify the steps, because the simpler it is, the easier it is to execute by the lay rescuer. Now, I don't want to take this as an opportunity to advise listeners on how to do CPR. You know, there are plenty of courses, for example, from St. John's Ambulance, where you can gain that information, but some of the changes that I would point out is that breathing and pulse checks have actually been minimized, because they've learned very rapidly that the success rate and the ability of the lay rescuer to conduct an accurate pulse and breathing check is actually pretty low. And also, the option to do CPR without mouth-to-mouth breathing has been encouraged, especially for first aiders who are unable or unwilling to conduct the mouth-to-mouth breathing. So one of the main causes identified that contributes to incorrect performance of CPR is the complexity of the protocol. And so it is being simplified. And the other thing, obviously, is that we lack real life experience. I think something like 20 to 30% of us are likely to ever attempt CPR in our lifetimes. And even then, it may only be once. So where do you gain the experience to actually get good at this and to improve your skills? So this is where UBC's Team Idol has stepped into the picture. And it's this final point, this lack of real-life experience, that resonated with them and encouraged them to develop a modification of the standard CPR mannequins used in training. And this is a modification that would more accurately reflect a real-life scenario. The team members of Team Idol are Caleb Ho, Johnny Ho, Alan Huang, and Noel Wu. And they showcased their interactive mannequin system in Seoul, Korea, not long ago, at an event hosted by Microsoft called the Imagine Cup. And this is an international student technology competition. To simplify it, Team Idol has made a portable solution that is scalable, it is interactive, and it can introduce an innovative upgrade to the standard CPR mannequin to help individuals learn and to help save lives ultimately. I had the opportunity to speak with Johnny Ho and Alan Huang of Team Idol about the CPR mannequin system, and they started out by telling me just exactly what it's capable of and how they got into this project.
So basically, we make an attachment onto a very, very popular CPR mannequin, Little Ann, and we made it interactive, so it provides a lot of feedback. For example, pose, breath, or like feedback of whether you're doing your CPR correctly. So that's basically the main idea.
What motivated you to choose that as your project?
The topic of this year's Imagine Cup is called Education for All, and we're trying to make a way to improve the education, and we know that CPR is one of the most important education, like a course that's offered for all the high school students, because they save lives.
Right. So, Johnny, what was the CPR machine like before you added your addition?
So, in ordinary CPR class, have you taken one, actually?
I have, actually,
Well, you have?
Long time ago.
Yeah, like a humanoid thing.
Yeah.
On the bottom. There's no... How do you know you're pressing it too much or too low? There's no feedback, right? So that's pretty much most existing solution out there. And actually, there's not a very small percentage of people using a special type of mannequins called interactive mannequins. So basically, they have sensors and actuators on there to try to simulate a more human-like environment. And they cost like a few thousand grand, so.
They cost how much?
A few thousand.
Yeah.
Or it can cost like up to 100,000 something.
Yeah.
So that's, most of the people offering these lessons are like, American Heart Association, not really profitable companies.
Yeah.
So it's too much to ask for them to pay that much for one mannequin. So basically what we come up with is attachment onto existing non-interactive, like traditional kind of dummy. And basically our thing is portable, so I can put on different mannequins and make them upgradable. And we did it in a low-cost fashion. So it's part of the engineering design, as we try to make part of the, I guess, the computer stuff, the logic stuff, onto a centralized small server. So in that case, we can offload the cost a lot more. So each attachment itself is only like $50 in material. So that's a lot cheaper. You can see on computer, so you have like a time graph of how well you're doing.
Okay.
And the little LED panel is for students themselves to kind of see how well they're doing at the moment. Have you played like, it's kind of, the idea comes from video games.
Yeah.
Have you heard of guitar?
Oh, yeah.
Kind of like, good, perfect. Or you'll be rating immediately on how accurate you are compared to the correct one, right?
Right.
So you can have like a different color for how well you're doing. So we kind of have that on the LED panel.
So when you're doing CPR, I know you're doing compressions, you're doing breathing.
Yeah.
There's all kinds of important things about positioning of the head and the neck. Probably the location of your hands during the compression, the strength of your breath, all these sorts of things.
Yeah.
Are those the kinds of things that you measure
exactly
when you give feedback?
Like, we measure the breath. We have like an airflow sensor to do that. So with that, we can measure like how deep the person is breathing, the volume, or the rate. So something like that. We have that. And we actually have a voice guiding feedback too. So we have basically the computer will actually kind of identify which state you're in, like which step you're supposed to do. You're supposed to check for danger or pinch and shout. So the computer will actually know if you did that step or not. So once you did a step, it'll guide you to the next procedure you're supposed to do. So you have like a, so we basically asked one of our friends, or our teammate's girlfriend, to do the voicing. So you kind of like, you know, please press, you know, a 30 compression and 2 breaths, you know, something like that. So the voice will actually kind of guide you through.
Right. Yeah. Is it, can you modify it to have less support and less guidance?
Oh, it could.
Because obviously, you know, you want some, it's not going to be there in a real situation, right? So
it could.
You can alter that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Can you also measure compression strength?
Yes.
All that sort of thing.
My compression sensors.
Sounds like a step up from when I took CPR myself.
And also, one of the big ideas is that our system is centralized. So basically, the instructor, he can only look at the computer and it will have results for all the students.
All right.
So basically, he doesn't have to run around and explain to students. That's why we also have the voice guidance thing.
Oh, cool. Alan, is this something that you're going to try and spin off into a company? Have you got some people interested in your concept? Or?
We've got a company interested, and we're trying to patent our idea, and we'll start the process very soon.
That was Alan Huang and Johnny Ho of UBC's Team Idol talking about their modification to the standard CPR mannequin dolls used in teaching the CPR skills. And I've had the opportunity to speak to a number of UBC groups over the years who have produced projects that have gone into competitions and succeeded. For example, you may remember an interview with Team Super Mileage, a team here from UBC that worked on ultra-efficient cars. I also interviewed Team Snowstar, a team working on developing a space elevator. One thing that is clear to me from interviewing these groups is that they all share the belief that UBC has prepared them well for their projects, and Team Idol was no exception.
Would you say that your studies at UBC helped you in doing this project?
Definitely. Actually, excluding the guy from engineering physics, all three of us are from this electrical second-year program called TIP.
Mm-hmm.
It's called Stanford Project Integrated Program. And I think that program is a little bit different from a traditional kind of program because we're, you know, it's traditional class, you just go to classrooms and take exams and listen to lectures. For project integrated program, you basically have like a 16-credit course, and all you do is work on one project. So each term you have 2 projects, so and it's not a year 4. But you're working in like a team environment, so it's quite realistic to what the real world is.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of got us going on working on projects as a team. I don't know, like, personally, winning is great, but, like, part of my greatest gain in this is working with my friends, I think. Just, you know, not just, you know, work, like, we play together, and, like, you know, we work till, like, 2 a.m. to go out to, like, late dinner or something like that. So I enjoy that part more, actually.
I ain't got no home, ain't got no shoes. Ain't got no money, ain't got no class, ain't got no skirts, ain't got no sweater, ain't got no perfume, ain't got no bed, ain't got no mind. Ain't got no mother, ain't got no culture, ain't got no friends, ain't got no schooling, ain't got no love, ain't got no name. Got my hair, got my head, got my brains, got my ears, got my eyes, got my nose, got my mouth, I got my smile. I got my tongue, got my chin, got my neck, got my boots, got my heart, got my soul, got my back, I got my sex.
For the last 4 years, InSight, Vancouver's supervised injection site, has proven to be an important part of the solution to Vancouver's drug addiction crisis. Scientific evidence concludes InSight prevents drug overdose deaths, reduces the spread of HIV and AIDS, and moves more people in drug detox and addiction treatment. Despite the science, Prime Minister Harper may not renew InSight's legal status, which will expire on December 31st, 2007. If InSight closes, people will die. Please support a comprehensive solution to drug addiction by visiting www.communityinsight.ca. Tell Prime Minister Harper to do the right thing and keep InSight saving lives.
I've seen the needle and the damage done. A little part of it in everyone. But every junkie's like a said.
Welcome back to My Science Project, and thanks for joining us. This is the Staying Alive show. And in keeping with our theme of life and death and life and death of the heart, I want to mention that the Lasker Awards have just been announced. This is an American award, which is regarded largely as the American Nobel Prize Award. In fact, since 1962, 71 Lasker Award recipients have gone on to win Nobel Prizes within 2 years of receiving the Lasker Award. And it's a set of awards that were established just after the Second World War by Albert and Mary Woodard Lasker. And they're put in place to raise public awareness of the importance of basic clinical biomedical research and the ability of this research to improve human life. There are four general categories that awards are given in, and they are outstanding basic medical research, clinical medical research, public service, and then often a special achievement award. This year, the award for outstanding achievement in basic medical research went to Ralph Steinman of the Rockefeller University for his discovery of dendritic cells, which are key players in the activation of immune responses, and for his work to elucidate the function of dendritic cells. The Public Service Award went to Anthony Fauci, the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease, for his work on a government program to treat HIV/AIDS in the developing world. But in keeping with our theme of life and death of the heart, I'm mentioning these awards because the winner of the award for clinical medical research went to Albert Starr of Portland, Oregon, and Alain Carpentier of Paris, France. Starr and Carpentier were honored for their contribution to the invention and application of prosthetic heart valves. The first heart valves were actually made out of silicon and Teflon by Albert Starr and Lowell Edwards in the late 1950s. The implantation of such devices, pioneered by Starr and Carpentier, revolutionized cardiology by giving patients with valvular disease a chance to survive. However, the silicon Teflon valves that were used early on led to blood clotting in the patients, rendering the recipients of the valves dependent on drugs to act as blood thinners for the rest of their lives. But in parallel to this, Alain Carpentier enrolled in a PhD program where his aim was to find a way to treat pig heart valves so that they would not be rejected when transplanted in humans. After all, already pig valves were known that they would not cause clotting. Instead, it was immune rejection by the host or the recipient of the valve that was the greatest issue. Carpentier discovered that treatment of pig valves with glutaraldehyde prevented rejection of the transplants because it significantly reduced the patient's immune response to the transplanted tissue. Consequently, he was able to perform the first glutaraldehyde-treated pig valve transplant in 1968. And rather than competing with each other, Carpentier and Starr soon became collaborators and remain friends to this day. Starr's company, originally established to manufacture Teflon heart valves, directed some efforts towards commercializing the glutaraldehyde-treated transplants. And together they share this award, transforming standard treatment of arterial stenosis. Now here at Mind Science Project, particularly on my show, you know that I'm rather amused to observe that either Tom Waits or Beck is able to come up with a tune that fits with just about any theme that I pick out. And today we're going to score one for Tommy Boy because he knocked it out of the park with a tune about life and death. And really, who did you expect to win a battle in that case? So here's Tom Waits with What Keeps Mankind Alive.
Thank you.
you gentlemen who think you have a mission to purge us of the seven deadly sins, should first sort out the basic food position, then start your preaching. That's where it begins. You're a lot who preach restraint and watch your waist as well, should learn for once the way the world is run. However much you twist, or whatever lies that you tell, food is the first thing, morals follow on. So first make sure that those who are now starving get proper helpings when we all start carving. What keeps mankind alive? What keeps mankind alive? The fact that millions are daily tortured, stifled, punished, silenced, and oppressed. Mankind is kept alive by bestial acts.
That was Tom Waite with What Keeps Mankind Alive. And at the beginning of the show, we started out talking about school and back to school and all those sorts of things. So I want to spend a few moments doing a little back-to-school recruitment here. First of all, you may remember a show earlier this year where I interviewed Erica Eliason of Let's Talk Science. And actually, Let's Talk Science is looking for volunteers right now. What it is, they're a volunteer group of UBC graduate and undergraduate students who are partnered with schools throughout Vancouver and, to some extent, throughout BC. And the aim is to bring excitement of science to kids in those schools. So the grad students, the undergrads, also postdocs are involved, and staff from all departments at UBC are partnered with high school and elementary school teachers to assist in their science activities. So it might include hands-on science activities, demonstrations, field trips, science fair judging, and so much more. It's a great group doing great work in the community on science. So if you would like to get involved, you can email them at lts@ubclts.com or check out their website, www.ubclts.com. And I'll also take a minute here to let you know that my science project, this very show that you're listening to at the moment, is looking for UBC correspondents. Julie and I would like to recruit science correspondents who can regularly prepare short pieces on all things science-y to air on this program. In particular, we're looking for a student or a couple of students to cover UBC science-related events, discoveries, controversies, and so on. CITR, the station here itself, offers a series of workshops to get you trained to be able to contribute in that way, and you would collaborate with Julia and I on a number of short news pieces. So we would love to hear from you if you are interested in that. For more information and to let us know about your interest, please email us at myscienceprojectradio@yahoo.ca or drop by CITR to become a member and initiate your introduction to the station. So if you'd like to be involved as a correspondent for My Science Project, where you'll contribute short pieces to our bi-monthly program, please email myscienceprojectradio@yahoo.ca. Also, take a moment here to let you know about a couple of cool events coming up around the city. Café Scientifique is ongoing this autumn. There is an event October 16th where Professor Alan Mackworth of UBC's Department of Computer Science will ask and maybe even answer the question, can robots do the right thing? So that's the robot event at the Railway Club on October 16th at 7:30 p.m. And also November 13th, UBC's Professor Curtis Suttle from the Department of Earth and Ocean Sciences will talk about of viruses, and his title is Viruses Rule the World, Stories from the High Seas. He's an expert in ocean viruses, and apparently there are thousands and thousands and thousands in every drop of water, many of which have never been identified or characterized before. So that's November 13th. Professor Curtis Suttle, also at the Railway Club. For more information about Café Scientifique, you can get in touch by emailing contact@cafesci-van.com. That's contact@cafesci-van.com. So we hope to see you at the Railway Club this autumn. Also, Science World has decided to throw together an event for adults only. It's called Science World After Dark, where you can explore, create, and discover just like a kid, but with a bottle of beer in your hand. So the TELUS World of Science opens its doors to adults only. That's tomorrow night, Friday, from 6:30 to 10 p.m. Admission is $16. It's 19 and over. A cash bar will be available. So there's lots of great stuff happening around town. Café Scientifique, Science World After Dark, adults only on Friday night. And don't forget to get involved a little bit this year in science. Maybe you could volunteer with Let's Talk Science or right here with My Science Project. Thanks for listening this week. We will be with you in early October on October 4th, a Thursday, Julie and I together for the CITR Funding Drive show, and we look forward to joining you then. This has been a slightly morbid show. It's all been about staying alive, but let's end with a little bit of humor and a favorite tune of mine by William Shatner called You'll Have Time.
Live life.
You're ready.
Live life like you're gonna die, because you're gonna fight to be the bearer of bad news, but you're gonna die. Maybe not today or even next year, but before you know it, you'll be saying, is this all there was? What was all the fuss? Why did I bother? Now, maybe you won't suffer, maybe it's quick, but you'll have time to think, why did I waste it? Why didn't I taste it? You'll have time, 'cause you're gonna die. Yes, it's gonna happen, because it's happened to a lot of people I know. My mother, my father, my loves, the president, the kings, and the pope. They all had hope, and they muttered just before they went, maybe I won't go. Live life like you're gonna die, because you are. Maybe you won't suffer, maybe it's quick, but you'll have time to think, why did I waste it? Why didn't I taste it? You'll have time, 'cause you're gonna die.
You're gonna die.
I tell you who else left us, passed on, gone to heaven, no longer with us. Johnny Cash.
Dead.
JFK, that guy in the Stones.
Dead.
Lou Gehrig, Einstein, and Joey Ramone.
Joey Ramone.
Have I convinced you? Do you read my lips?
Yeah.
This may come as news, but it's time. You're gonna die. You're gonna die. By the time you hear this, I may well be dead. And you, my friend, might be next.